Good morning, everybody. I will just pick up where Judith left off and move on. I, of course, also want to thank our funders, both from NIDR and SAMHSA, and our colleagues, Jessica Jonikas, Peggy Swarbrick, and the entire team in the health screening. For those of you who are looking for CEs, here are the learning objectives for this presentation, and I do not have any disclosures. As Judith has said, we launched a lot of these projects from the center looking at the health disparities that we see defined in Healthy People 2020. I've highlighted a couple here because for us particularly, the population of individuals in recovery, as we often refer to people with severe mental illnesses, come across these health disparities from a number of positions, whether or not it's poverty, but we also have mental health, disability, and certainly the exclusion or discrimination. And I think we've seen some population level health disparities that are fairly meaningful. Judith mentioned this, the mortality finding that individuals in recovery die about 25 years earlier from mostly preventable and treatable causes. But then I think the other one that's particularly relevant to my presentation is that the morbidity of these illnesses or the actual experience of symptoms is often well progressed where you might see an individual who does not live with a mental disturbance or mental illness and certainly might exceed somebody who is, you know, your average 52-year-old white woman in the general population. And so that's something to think about. One study, as you can see here, the Sokol study saw in 200 individuals with schizophrenia some specific issues related to respiratory illness, viral liver diseases, and diabetes, as Judith mentioned. These are, we don't like to call them the big six, but these are the major illnesses, in addition to diabetes, that we see the greatest level of disparity in the population. And obviously, you know, Judith has discussed diabetes, but then you see cardiovascular diseases, which also have a connection to poorly managed diabetes, can attack your heart muscle in addition to your eyes, your teeth, and the circulation disorder is most likely to present in your feet, but that's also attacking your heart muscle. Hypertension and high cholesterol, as Judith mentioned, whether or not you're living with diabetes, we saw particularly disparate rates in the population. Renal and kidney diseases, and liver diseases that are non-viral, and I think those two issues are really important. Liver diseases can be related to alcoholism and the long-term use of psychotropic medications. Same thing with renal diseases in terms of processing the pharmacology that you might use to treat your mental health, as well as any co-occurring physical illness you have. But then also, if you're someone living with untreated hypertension, you may be seeing the effects on your kidneys of not treating your hypertension. And so you see, I hate to say a domino effect, but you see a kind of additive effect that one illness untreated is starting to create risk factors in other illnesses that you have. Infectious diseases, an area where both Judith and I also do some specific research related to individuals with mental health issues and HIV, tuberculosis, hepatitis B and C, and then respiratory conditions, many of which are related to the extremely disparate rates of smoking and nicotine use that you see among individuals with mental health disorders. I also want to mention that shy maybe of the infectious diseases and some of the liver diseases, these are also primarily diseases of aging. And our risk factors as a population for all of these illnesses go up as we age. And so that's something I think developmentally in the process of mental health and working with people in recovery, we need to speak more about. It's not just that they die sooner, but if they're living, they're going to be living with the same progressive illnesses that we all are. I won't ask for a show of hands, but how many of you know your risk factors for these illnesses based on your age and gender and other demographic features, and do we address them? I will admit I know my risk factors. I am in pervasive denial of most of them. Other risks that we see from the comorbidity of substance abuse, and I did put the pack of cigarettes in a disparate size here because nicotine is extremely influential. I've also made the beer a little larger because alcoholism is, and use of alcohol is an issue. Those are also legal drugs or legal use chemicals. And so while we may talk about recreational drugs, marijuana, heroin, other things, people feel a sense of entitlement about drinking or about smoking. And so since they're available, those are things that are oftentimes going to be harder for you to crack. But you can see here that substance abuse, because of its effect on your immune system, because of its effect on inflammation, you see a lot of disorders here that, again, are going to be worse or at least exacerbated by substance use. And then there's incarceration. We have some colleagues here from the criminal justice world, and I think that they would all agree from a public health perspective, being incarcerated is not necessarily the healthiest thing for anybody. Judith alluded to some of these, so I will just, you know, mention the internal and personal factors that we talk about in terms of people's health and health literacy. this is not something that I would say is exclusive to people in recovery. Again, I would say these issues are exacerbated among people in recovery because these things are going to appear more frequently. But everyone in, you know, the American population could probably deal a little more about our motivation for medical treatment, some of our unhealthy lifestyles that we lead. And so I want to say that because this is in no way to indict or say that people in recovery are not as attentive to their health as the general population. I'm not sure all of us are very attentive to our health, is at least as much as we should be. Provider factors can also be something that we encounter. We work with the College of Medicine and the College of Nursing, and I think Judith alluded to the College of Nursing is very prepared. Over in the College of Medicine, when I ask young medical students, are you interested in going to psychiatry, what do you think young medical students say to me? They kind of look at me puzzled and they say, but Dr. Rosano, I'm here to treat sick people. And I kind of look at them and I say, come over to the Department of Psychiatry. I will provide you with some people, aside from their psychiatric symptoms, who have serious medical illnesses, multiple medical illnesses. And so some of these issues among providers, at least in terms of even the youngest people in the workforce, are unknown. And you're not going to really encounter a physician who understands the intersection between mental health and these physical illnesses until you reach residence, really. And in my opinion, and that's my opinion, it's way too late for them to engage in this process. And so one of the things that our center is working on as a result of this program is to try and bring that training earlier about the intersection of mental health and chronic physical illnesses to the workforce when they're very young and they're very open to things that they haven't necessarily encountered. So this is something, you know, that we're really working on at the ground level. You'll also see some clinical factors, you know, medication interactions. Some of the issues we confront with diabetes can also be driven and fueled by the use of certain psychotropic medications, poor medication adherence, and then low health literacy and ambivalence, which are two things that I think are particularly relevant to the data that I'm going to present about our health fair program and how we talk to people a little bit about their health literacy and kind of familiarize themselves with themselves, which was a really interesting and powerful outcome, I think, for all of us in the research program. And then, you know, systemic factors, which we all talk about. Hopefully less bifurcation of medical and mental health systems, but I think that's tricky, particularly with the most disabled people and the ones that experience the most mental health requirements. Funding, we're in Illinois, but, you know, for those of you not Illinois, I'm sure you live in states where funding can be complicated in terms of how these programs are rolled out. And then, you know, emphasis on treating. I have a brother who's in the military, and he always tells me that I don't just need a tactical approach to my question, which is very short term, but I need a strategic mission to go with my tactical approach. And so I think we're very tactical in medicine, and we need a little bit more strategic planning for that long term activity in terms of how the mission is going to go. So we were interested in conducting some health assessments that focused on a number of issues. What are the person's health strengths, which is something not only I think public health recognizes, but in our role in mental health, we do a lot of modeling related to what's called psychiatric rehabilitation, which is more interested in focusing on consumers' and clients' strengths and their weaknesses. Where can we build, you know, communication? Where can we build problem solving? Will there be personal goals? Do they have health risks that they know of? Would they be able to identify what exactly the health risks are from smoking? I ask people all the time, what's your health risk from smoking besides lung cancer? And they look at me, and they're not sure. They don't connect emphysema as much. They don't connect pancreatic cancer to smoking, other kinds of respiratory illnesses, dental problems. And so sometimes you've got that big thing that everyone's worried about, lung cancer, and they're forgetting all the other illnesses that they can also get along with that. And then what's their health status? And I think that's something that most of us don't necessarily attend to every day, and certainly something that we found with the individuals that we worked with in our health fair program. So the way that we went about our health screening was we were really approaching it from a risk identification. We were interested in talking to people about their patient history and family history. I'm interested, if any of you work in mental health, ask the people in your program, has anybody ever actually done a family history of medical illness for that client? They'll know everything about their family history of schizophrenia or bipolar disorder or alcoholism, but oftentimes they've never asked, did your mother have breast cancer? Did any other women in your family have breast cancer? Are there any other health risk factors other than psychiatric risks that we really should be talking about? And then how could we, in a way, identify issues and risks for them? Our job was really not to be diagnostic in a health fair, and I think most of you would agree with that. It's an informational opportunity. It's an opportunity to open some awareness to people about additional screening and potentially more rigorous kinds of diagnosis that they would need. And so it was an opportunity we felt in a very low-stress, welcoming way to get people to start thinking about their health in a more community way and decide what were the things that maybe they would need to move on and do more about. You know, and for us, we got some very interesting, I would also say disturbing data about health disparities. And again, I mentioned this serving really as a cue to action from that traditional health beliefs model about how people can engage in their health. So the tests that we used in our health screening were something that we came up with as a team in concert with a colleague of ours, Peggy Swarbrick, at the Community Collaborative Support Programs of New Jersey. She is a person who has worked a lot in the consumer movement about health and mental health. And these were the ways that we approached it. So in our pretest, because we did do a model where we did a pretest interview with consent of individuals, where we asked them some questions about family history. We used the NHANES for those. We asked them some questions about, has anyone ever told you you were diagnosed with 17 different illnesses, which mapped back to those first ones I talked about that were like those big six illnesses. We asked some health screening scales. I'll talk some more about those, some attitudinal measures. Then we had people go out into the health fair and participate in the health fair. After the health fair, we asked them some post-test questions, which were mostly, again, the attitudinal measures, the demographics, and some things that were easier for them to report on the way out and some satisfaction. These were the stations of our health fair, not just the topics that we talked about. So the first one was body mass index, and we did approach that in a very sensitive way. We did take body mass in terms of height, waist, weight, and waist circumference. I apologize about that hanging comma. Because we also were not just interested in obesity and characterizing obesity, which we did, but these are a couple of the same indicators, weight and waist circumference, are things that you often use to define metabolic syndromes in psychiatry. And so we wanted to ensure that not only were we looking at obesity in a more traditional way, but could we use this in the way that medical psychiatry and physicians actually define the metabolic syndromes that characterize this population a lot of times. Diabetes, we tested with A1C. We had this great team of nurses who did most of the blood sticking for us and kept us really on a simple sort of, you know, A1C, as Judith noted, is a great indicator for diabetes. One of the reasons it works great at a health fair is that you don't have to fast for an A1C. You can actually go to Target, a Walgreens, a CVS, whatever your drug store of choice is, pick up an A1C and do it in your own home. It's got the finger stick. It's got everything you need. A1C is more of a maintenance test. It's more of an example of where your glucose is over a three-month period than a fasting glucose, which is what it is today. How many of you have done a fasting glucose? How many of you were really careful and ate really properly the week up to your fasting glucose? Okay, just me. But you can't game the A1C in this same way. So again, we didn't need phlebotomy, we didn't need fasting, and we got a more accurate of what's your kind of average approach to how you might be managing your A1C. Blood pressure was done with electronic cuffs. I was often at the blood pressure station. We did have the nurses there, and I can tell you in a couple of instances with our health fairs, we actually had people who were in ridiculously dangerous levels of blood pressure where we actually had to call the nurses, and in some cases we would seek medical attention. One of the things that we built into our health fair was identifying that if we had a level that seemed particularly dangerous or that person was a little fragile or vulnerable, we had the nurses intervene, and in I think very few, but maybe 2 to 3 cases across the entire study, we did have people that we recommended see the paramedics. One was because his A1C was, I want to say, 14. And another person, their blood pressure was extremely high and very dangerous. Their heart health, or cholesterol and triglycerides, easy for me to say. We tested also with a blood stick. The heart health, we used a multivariable computer program from the Framingham Health Study. We used the nicotine addiction or nicotine addiction score from the Fagerstrom nicotine assessment. The we use for alcohol was the AUS, it was the DAS, the drug abuse screening test, and the audit C. So all rigorous measures, no diagnostic measures really, screening measures to try and say to people where are your risk factors and what can you do about them. Well, these are all summarized in a health passport that you can get on our website, and if you look at this, all of the stations that we just talked about are described. We handed these out to participants and wrote their values in for them, and next to them, written again as Judith noted, in an approachable non-jargony lexicon, more at the 6th to 8th grade level, is what is A1C, what does it mean, what are the normative values, so that they could go to a physician or a provider if they had a risk, tell them the test they had, tell them the type of information that they were using and what their outcome was so they could start a dialogue. We had 4 events, New Jersey, Illinois, Maryland, and Georgia. We tested around 450 people in recovery. These are traditionally the types of demographics that you see among most populations. We still, I think, tend to see to underrepresent Latinos, but I think that's something that's indicative of a lot of the research that we do in the field. We see here that the majority of individuals are all living with the most severe psychiatric symptoms, and you can see that with 89% using psychiatric medications, many of those symptoms were disabling and pervasive enough that they needed a type of pharmacological intervention. So these are very, you know, severely psychiatrically disabled individuals, many of them. Here are the health risks we can detect. You can see in yellow what we found in our health for participants and what we see in the U.S. population. I always like to pause and say, U.S. population doesn't look so great either. So when we talk, you know, to people in recovery, we're saying one more health risk you have to worry about like everybody else in this country. As Judith noted, there's 2 to 3 times the rate among individuals in recovery for most of these health conditions that we tested compared to rates in the U.S. population. And so this alone for us, again, as epidemiological data, as question, you know, formulation data have been very, very valuable to us. So as I've noted, we see a higher rate of these illnesses, mostly preventable, mostly treatable. Some cases were closer to the general population. So, for example, the hypertension finding was a little lower than we expected, but then when we asked people, some of them were already on medication for hypertension. So what we detected was more management than risk in that particular case. The other thing that we found was that even attending a health fair, which was about 50, you know, probably about 90 minutes to 2 hours, depending on how quickly people move through, we saw significant improvements in their own self-rated abilities for health, their perceived competence for their own health maintenance, and then 2 of the areas, the internal control and powerful others from the multidimensional health locus of control. I think the results here are from the fact that as people went around to each of their stations, they had an individual do their test, but then speak with them about what the results of their test meant, and they actually gave them a handout that corresponded to that health passport I showed you that listed what are the risks. It defined what the health condition is on one side, and when you flipped it over, it told you what the risks are and 2 or 3 very common and easy ways, other than, say, a medication that you'd need from a doctor, that you could reduce your risk for that particular issue. And so we were excited to know that something as approachable and community-based and inclusive as a health fair that was done by mental health researchers, by other people in recovery who are trained peer providers, not a lot of physicians, was able to affect some change in not only the health literacy of people, but really their self-rated ability to go out and do some things themselves. So in creating and sustaining a health-related community in mental health programs, these are some things that we've recommended, not only in terms of how you can assist people with some experience or some limited experiences, but how you can invite other community providers who are going to be players in that. Nurses, doctors, blood banks. One of the most popular things we had at the health fair was we contacted massage therapy schools, and during the waiting process, we had a chair massage where you could get a free 10-minute massage, which was great for the providers who had brought the clients to the health fair. But also, many clients had never had a massage, and they had misconceptions about what that massage was going to look like and who was going to do it and did they have to take the clothes off. We're like, no. And so they really experienced that in a positive way. Same with the guy we had at UIC who did Reiki, who was the most popular station unquestionably in the whole thing. So, you know, conduct regular health screenings. Keep in mind that people with multiple obstacles are going to encounter these health problems. And then I think, you know, you can visit 3 of our publications from the study. One, the Cook and All, is about this particular event. The other publication is more about health disparities and predictors of those in multivariate modeling. And then Peggy and her team worked with us to do a thing on the dialogues of health screening from a more qualitative perspective. You can reach us at the center for all of these materials. And I thank you very much.